The next speaker is Glenn Eustace from Massey University. Glenn has worked at Massey University since 1980. He's worn a number of hats during that period and involved in systems and management of networking. He is currently responsible for business continuity and disaster recovery, but he still wears a senior network engineering hat, and he's going to tell us about the experience that Massey University has gone through in adopting PV6. Thanks, Glenn.
And Massey didn't really have a specific reason to. I started looking at it probably about 3 years ago and made sure that in each of our procurement cycles, whenever we went out to buy things, that V6 was on the agenda. We didn't really know what we were going to do with it, but we knew that it was coming, and so we wanted to make sure that when it came time to do something with it, that we had something to do it with. Our reasons really are related to being able to interconnect with research peers when the Karen network came online. And whilst I haven't had anybody pounding on my door saying I must have V6 to talk to somebody in Japan, the way that Massey has engineered our network, I wouldn't know whether that's what they were doing anyway. I wanted to make sure that if somebody did come and pound on my door, it wouldn't be for that particular reason, because we would have already provided that connectivity. And we also want to make sure that in the event of people in the IPsec only parts of the world wanted to make use of Massey's resources, either through distance education or just finding out what our researchers were up to, that they could do that too. So I wanted to ensure that some of our public-facing services were available in that way. And I think one of the other things was to really just find out how ready were we. It's quite difficult to actually look at your own infrastructure and find out which pieces are and which pieces aren't capable of actually assisting you on the journey. I think it is very worthwhile pointing out that deployment of V6 was not a project. There was no attempt to find any money to do it. It was just a case of it got lumped in with everything else. Every time there was an opportunity to look at it, it got put on the table. And I've been basically working on it over the last 3 years. It's a bit do a bit here, do a bit there. There hasn't been a concerted effort to actually see it all done by a particular time or date. The deployment goals for V6 on the campus were basically initially to make sure that we could talk V6 in amongst ourselves. We have three sites, Auckland, Palmerston and Wellington, and we wanted to ensure that we could actually use V6 as a transport within that environment. Most of our desktops are Windows, I think something like about 86% or something are Windows platforms. All the recent versions of Windows are V6 enabled by default, and in many cases people will be using V6 and they're not even aware they're doing so. And then we wanted to be able to talk to our research peers in various parts of the world. The Internet too is probably the IPv6 backbone around the planet at the moment, and most of the people that are actively doing things in that space are connected to that network. But we also wanted to ensure that as soon as we had a commodity Internet that talked V6, that we'd be in a position to make use of that as well. I wanted to hit the high points, basically, the quick wins. I'm basically the only networking person that's actually working in this space, so I didn't want to spend hours and hours and hours working on all of the hard ones. So I wanted to ensure that initially we got those things that were easy to test, easy to determine whether they were working or not, namely DNS, NTP, email, and Telnet and SSH. And I won't call it a trick, but we made use of the same idea that Google had chosen to use of actually specifically having a Quad A record just for ipv6.massey.ac.nz, which when I tried it, the funny thing was we actually did it at almost exactly the same time. When I tried it from here this morning, it didn't work, which was interesting. It seems that there's a little bit of a routing problem with our prefix not being advertised through the other from the route servers at APE at the moment. So it was quite interesting because when I tried to trace route, the traffic headed off through Vocus over into Australia, through Arnet and off into the wide blue yonder, which was kind of interesting. But anyway, the idea was that by enabling part of our infrastructure and the way Massey does its websites, we have reverse proxies in front of all the corporate websites. I could create a single reverse proxy for the IPv6 site pointing to the corporate website over V4, so it's exactly the same content, but you have to choose to use it. So we could use it as a test, and we used that from off-site and from other institutions to make sure things worked, but we weren't in a position of breaking our web infrastructure without having given the web team some idea that that's what we were intending to do to them. Right, well, how did we get on? We enabled all of the Cisco equipment that we have, and Massey is a Cisco house. Anything that had V6 on it, we turned it on. We enabled our checkpoint firewalls for IPv6 as well, and found that there were some limitations in that particular implementation. The platforms that we deliver our services from were had good dual-stack implementations, Red Hat Linux, Windows 2003 and 2008. We turned on native IPv6 and a couple of subnets in ITS so that we could try things out in the real world, and then enabled EtherTAP as a tunneling technology for basically the rest of our clients. So we have people on a lot of the areas of the campus using EtherTAP now, and they don't even know that they're doing so. I'll give Microsoft a big, huge tick for their tunneling technologies. It's all automagic, and if things are actually set up right, it just works. What were the issues that we struck? Well, this one created a bit of discussion yesterday. It was interesting. Our first big hurdle was actually getting some IPv6 address space out of APMIC. It turned out that an enterprise is not as considered to be an end user, and you don't get any, I'm sorry, pardon. And by the way, you're also not a provider and can't provide 200/48s in 2 years, so you don't get any. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. After a number of emails backwards and forwards, the word university came into the conversation, and they decided, oh, well, maybe you can have some. So it took far longer than anticipated. I understand that those allocation policies have now been revised somewhat. I don't know how liberal they are, but I believe they're not as liberal as perhaps I would like them to be. Certainly, they didn't seem to have taken into account an enterprise that is multi-homed must have their own address space. You can't just rely on an upstream to provide it for you. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in that space. And I think this one caught us out as well. We were more than a little disappointed by the lack of support of IPv6 in our Cisco equipment. The top-end devices, sure, it had it. The lower platforms, and I won't go too far down the list, but 4500s and 3750s, which are our other Layer 3 platforms, on the label it says they support V6, but when it came down to it, the feature set that we wanted to use simply did not exist. Now, this was sort of 18 months ago, and I'm very pleased to announce that in the last 2 weeks, the releases of iOS that we now have access to fully support on those platforms all of the features that we require. So we didn't have to buy any new hardware, and under our support agreement, we didn't have to buy any new software, and so we get access to the features that we required. This was one of the features that was missing, by the way. But this is one of the issues that we are really struggling with at the moment. IPv6, as it was originally sort of set up, seemed to take a position where auto-configuration was a great idea. For toasters and fridges and cell phones and all of those things where you really don't care what address it gets so long as it gets one, it's a great idea. But when you're actually put in a position of having to try and audit or moderate behavior of your client base, you need to know which address got assigned to what piece of equipment. So we do that with stateful configuration through DHCP. In version 4, it's a no-brainer. Everybody knows how to do DHCP in version 4. Version 6, all the wheels come off. It's one where I'm still working through some of the problems associated with that. If you use DHCP with your servers, and people may or may not, that's a religious argument a bit. We do, but we give fixed leases to those services. Again, trying to get the unique identifier that you have to use, and it's not the MAC address, folks, to identify the computer to say this is the lease you're going to get, again, proves to be quite an interesting exercise. Yes, there is a unique identifier. Do you know it in advance? No. So you can't take something out of the box and just plug it in and have it work the way you want to. You actually have to run it up first. It then gets its unique identifier, which you then have to find out what it is, and then work out how your admin systems are going to deal with that new quantity. This is the one I think that's going to trip everybody up, and it's certainly the one that we've had some issues with. There are lots of soft issues that are going to sneak out of the woodwork. You're going to find that IPv6 addresses start popping up in web server log files that you didn't expect them to be. If you're running your own analysis programs, their parsing routines are going to crap out when they find that they've got an IP address which doesn't look like it's supposed to. You're going to find that if you're recording IP numbers in databases, all of a sudden they don't fit in the column that you thought you had enough space for them. It really is an issue that unless you know your applications very well, and in the case of some of the third-party stuff where you don't have access to the source anyway and don't know what assumptions have been made in the code, you could find that the application works, but there are problems in the back end of it. In other words, when you start processing some of the data that application has to work with. After having been doing it now for a couple of years and having talked to a few people in this room over the last couple of days, I know Massey have done some things wrong, and I'll be going back and having another look at some of those things. Fortunately, by you having used IzzaTap, we haven't got it all over the place, and it's fairly contained, and I can make changes reasonably easily. But the big thing is, don't let IPv6 happen to you. Be proactive. Get in there now and happen to it. Make your choices and get your designs and your planning going so that you are in control of the process. The statement that's been made of trying to engineer things in a panic is doomed to fail, and I would say that's very, very much the case. Make sure you start talking now with your ISPs. Most of them don't seem to have a policy or a plan to support V6. In the early days, we got nowhere. We only found when we went out to our latest RFP for internet traffic, there were two ISPs that were prepared to deliver IPv6 to us. And we chose one of those, and their delivery was over an experimental network over a tunnel. So there's not a lot there. I understand the situation is changing. Congratulations, FX, for getting on and getting on with it. And I think the other one that's probably worth mentioning is that it isn't necessarily as hard as you think it's going to be. You might be very surprised by how much stuff just works. As I said, the client implementations in Windows, Linux, BSD, everything, they are very solid and they do just work. Most of the servers, if you're delivering off those platforms, just work as well. The applications are where you might find that you've got a bit of strife, but if you get in there early and actually start looking at what you're trying to do, you might find that they're not as bad as they look either. Thank you. Oh, there's a slightly more detailed description of some of the activities that we have done included in the handout, and I apologise for plagiarising it, but I did contact the authors from Penn State and they agreed that they were writing at exactly the same time that I was, and so we basically shared some of the information. Thank you, Murray.
Thank you, Glenn. Is there one question? Yes, Keith.
Become very liberal to the extent that content providers who are hosting on multi-hosting platforms can get an allocation without any problems at all. They're serious about wanting to get IPv6 out there. So, and that's an allocation that I think is in a special block and it's free. So
yep.
I'll put that on record.
This was 2 years ago, Keith.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I'm not saying that you were wrong. You were probably exactly right at the time. But
yep.
I'm just observing that AP Nick had made this statement. And what's more, I want it on the record so that we can hold it. And then my unfair question, because you're from the technical background at Massey, but I just wonder if within the computer science department, if IPv6 is a part of the curriculum, i.e. are techies being trained in IPv6 within Massey?
I'd love to answer you, but honestly, I have very little involvement with the academic side of the university, and I simply don't know.
Andy's going to tell us all about that shortly, though.
Yeah. Just to pick Keith's point up about AP Nick having made this statement that they're doing this. The policy is due for discussion in Beijing next week, and I'm going to ask people some questions about it, but it isn't happening. Please don't put it on the record, but that policy has been passed. I have a very strong feeling it will be, but it hasn't actually been agreed as we speak right now.
Oh, Paul, guaranteed it's an
I'm one of the authors of the proposal, and I know that we've still been having arguments about it right now.
See you outside.
Yeah.
Well, it was an interesting session. Thank you very, very much indeed. Much appreciated. I think there's a real illustration of what you need to do and some of the issues that you encounter, and I think that provides some very useful guidance. And we will get the AP next issue sorted out, and you'll sort it out for us next week, if it's not already done so. Right, moving on. I'd now like to introduce Kevin Karp. He is the founder and managing director of PPS Internet. He has over 25 years of experience in board level commercial management of ICT and industry investment. In 2007, he negotiated and directed PPS's acquisition of StudentNet. So StudentNet is actually what he's going to talk about today. He also jointly founded IPv6 Now.
He is a founding member and secretary of Internet Society Australia, senior member of the Association for Computing Machinery, and a fellow of the Financial Services Institute of Australia. So we welcome Kevin to the podium. Been very, very helpful throughout our activities with the steering group so far, and we welcome your presentation. Thank you.
Doing another piece of minor repair.
Thank you for that introduction, Murray, and for your presence here today. StudentNet, as I said, as Murray indicated, we got involved with StudentNet about 2 years ago, and when we inherited what we got with StudentNet, we realised that there were some, it was seriously out of date, and they had some serious issues with regard to their product. Wearing my IPv6 Now hat, we consulted with the IPv6 Now team and said, okay, what can we do for StudentNet to help upgrade the services that they've got and make it a more affordable and more feature-rich product for the schools? StudentNet's in the business of providing services to schools, internet-related services to schools. They're not a service provider, but since 1995 they've provided things like web hosting, email hosting and other internet services. They've been doing it for a long time, but their product had got out of date and had become too expensive. So we decided to revamp the product line entirely and to make it a much richer feature set. The StudentNet was providing their services to some 30-odd schools, and they had over 5,000 accounts that they were dealing with amongst those schools. To give you an idea of the range of the schools that we're talking about, we're talking all the way from the very largest privately funded wealthy independent schools in Australia down to tiny, tiny fundamentalist religious schools that might only have less than 100 pupils in the school. That sector, actually, the small fundamentalist religious school, is the largest and fastest growing sector of the Australian education sector at the moment. So it's a marketplace that you can't ignore. They're working on very tight budgets, very limited administrative facilities and technology facilities, and as part of the StudentNet offering, we needed to be able to cater to the needs of those schools as well as the very large schools. Some of the features that we introduced as part of the features of the accounts that the StudentNet would now be providing was the provision of lifelong domain names. I'll be going into this into these features in a little bit more detail in a few moments. We also wanted to not only provide email facilities. The schools were now moving on to Gmail, webmail-based email. But we also wanted to provide a secure and controlled collaboration environment for the schools. The schools increasingly don't do schooling at the school itself. There's a lot of school work that's now happening outside of the school. We also wanted to think of the administrators of all of these accounts within the schools themselves, and we wanted to simplify and improve their life. And so we looked at the provision of a single sign-on administration facility, and this again makes use of features such as Google's API for administering sign-ons to Gmail. It's amazing the job that these IT managers do with the resources that they've got. If I went to a commercial organisation in downtown Sydney and said, you're going to have a network with 1,200 users on it that are very demanding users, and those 1,200, you're going to have this budget to administer those 1,200 users and only a couple of staff to do it, they just throw their hands up and say that it can't be done. But that's what the IT directors within schools are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. We looked and asked the schools what would be your requirements for a revamp of your services. We recognised that the schools are all different. They're independent and they're extremely different in the way that they operate. A fundamentalist Islamic school is going to be completely different to a large, non-denominational, well-funded, wealthy school. We recognised that we would be dealing with student accounts, we'd be dealing with teacher accounts, and we'd be dealing with administration accounts. So three different types of accounts that we could be dealing with within the one organisation. The IT directors emphasised to us how much control that they needed of administration. There's a lot that they need to be worried about, and it was a very important requirement for them that they have fine-grained administrative control of the of what was happening in the accounts that we were setting up. To the education sector in general, there's one overriding important factor in everything that they do, and that's protecting the children that are in their care. They're dealing with kids that are all the way from first class right up to year 12 children, and there's a wide range of protection for those children means different things at different times during the lifetime of those kids. One of the schools... The other thing that was important was that not only do we need to protect the children from outside influences, but we also need to protect the children from themselves. Cyberbullying is a very, very topical problem that the schools are dealing with at the moment. The Australian government just 2 weeks ago announced a project out of Melbourne that they've funded to the tune of $3 million specifically to look at what can be done about cyberbullying. Of course, that's not a technology problem, and technology can't be expected to deliver the solution, but we needed to ensure that, number one, we weren't making anything worse, and number two, that if we could, we could make things a little bit better. And finally, it needed to be easy to use. Not so much easy to administer. Of course, it needed to be easy to administer. That's what the IT directors wanted us to do. But it needed to be easy to use. You've got administrators in schools that are not particularly IT aware and IT literate. You've got school kids that have got a lot of other things that they've got to learn. You don't want to burden them with too much to learn for them to make use of these facilities. Okay, in detail, looking under the hood, each school receives a /48 address allocation from StudentNet. They don't use all of the /48 from day one. 1/64 is set aside just for the collaboration accounts that have been set up for the students and the parent and the teachers and administrators. That /64, we fairly arbitrarily chose that /64 to be the final /64, the very last /64 out of the entire /48 range. We did that because we said to the schools, if you wish to make use of the rest of the /48 range, you can do so. There's a charge associated with it. It's an expense, but you have the ability to do so. And we decided, mainly for perception reasons, to put the /48 that we were going to occupy, sorry, the /64 that we were going to occupy at the very end, so that when the IT people within the school start looking at the range and saying, well, what can I use, they're not going to be distracted by this thing at the very beginning of the range or somewhere in the middle. That allows them to maximise any subnet ranges that they may wish. They can set aside a single /49, a single /50, or they could have put aside 3/50s. They can structure that as they wish. As I said, the additional /64s, if the schools want to start using IPv6 within their organisation, they've got those subnet ranges that they can make use of if they wish, at a charge. That's an extra product. One of the requirements that we had, as I said, the IT directors are very stretched. Some of them are only just keeping up technically with the demands that are being made of them with their existing environment. For them to have to learn a whole new protocol would be a large imposition. For them to have to remodify the way the school is already working was going to be an onerous imposition. So one of our requirements was that we couldn't have any impact. We couldn't request the school to change anything in order for them to be able to use these collaboration accounts. This is part of the reason why we chose to implement this as a tunnel-based product, and we wanted to make the tunnel-based product as seamless and as transparent as we could for the schools. Now, the reality is that of the 30-odd schools that are now using StudentNet's collaboration accounts, only a few of them are aware that they're using V6. When we talk to them about collaboration accounts, we never mention V6 at all. This has not been a tool for IPv6 now to market V6 to 30-odd technical environments. Occasionally, some of the more technically aware IT directors scratched their heads when we described it to them, and they said to us, well, hang on a minute, how are you doing all this? And we're quite happy to look under the hood with them and lift the hood for them and explain to them how it's all happening so that they can understand the implications and any possibilities that it may arise for their own network. But by and large, the vast majority of the schools, I would say that it's only about 3 or 4 of the 30 schools that have actually asked to look under the hood in that fashion, and all the rest have not, they don't care. As long as the facility works, they're happy. We needed to ensure that the schools had the ability to choose what level of security they were going to employ, what sort of collaboration was going to occur. And there's essentially 3 levels that they can choose from. The first level is that school kids in this school can only collaborate with other school kids in this school, or teachers in this school can only collaborate with other teachers or school kids in this school. The next level up, the second level, was to say, okay, we open up the collaboration so that schools that are within StudentNet can collaborate with other schools that are within StudentNet. And the final level is, doesn't make any difference whether you're part of StudentNet or not, you can collaborate with anybody else that's got the appropriate technical facilities in place. We don't determine which of the 3 levels the schools are going to receive. The schools do that for us, and they can change that whenever they want to, and they can change it on a temporary basis as well. This was also part of the benefit that we got by going with a tunnel-based approach to what we were doing, was that we would be able to have this control and flexibility and offer that to the schools. Okay, the way it works is that each, let's say it's a student in this case, each student has a domain name that is given to them. They've got a tunnel broker account, in effect. When they log into the tunnel, the tunnel is being established, the IP address is being established, and the domain name for that student is created and mapped to the IP address for that student. The domain name only exists for the period, for the length of time of the session. So as soon as the student signs off, the domain name disappears, so that all opportunity to collaborate with that student now goes, and the domain name record is they're removed from the domain name records, and it's as if it was never there. We have experienced some problems with this in that there is a delay between when the student signs into the tunnel broker account and when the domain name service actually gets created. There's a delay of some 10 minutes or so before the domain name record gets updated. We thought that 10 minutes, well, who's going to really notice 10 minutes? And it turns out that every school kid notices 10 minutes, because 10 minutes is an awful long time to a teenager. We've had to make sure that people are aware of this because otherwise we're going to get swamped with phone calls saying, oh, the service isn't working. There's a similar delay when they sign off. They sign off and their domain name is still visible for a short period of time, about 10 minutes after they've signed off. But of course, once they've signed off, the IP address has been cancelled, so even though the domain name system still knows about them, they're no longer there. We also, in an attempt to ease the administration for the IT directors, we created a single sign-in facility, sign-in administration. So what this means is that the administrator can go to one screen and update the password for any student, and when they update that password will be updated not only in our tunnel facility, but also in Google's Gmail, the school's own Active Directory or LDAP directory, if that's what they're running, and any other web service that's using either SAML, RADIUS, or LDAP to do authentication. So that means if the school is running a Moodle server, or if the school is accessing a third party's Moodle server, and the administrator wants to change the password, they go in and change one password, and all of those accounts get updated at the same time. This came from an observation from one of the IT directors. He told us that a year 11 or 12 student in New South Wales may be required to have 5, 6, 7 separate web sign-ins to facilities that are external to the school. So as part of satisfying the curriculum and syllabus for that child needs to have these external sign-ins. So with this facility, we've been able to give them. As long as the external web server satisfies one of those three conditions, they can be built in. They can be brought into this single administration facility. Okay, so the question arises, how would you do this if you were doing it in V4? How would you provide the lifelong domain name feature? How would you provide IP address level control and granularity? When the student signs in, they're signing in, creating their tunnel account, getting their domain name, and getting the same IP address. That IP address is tied to that domain name, is tied to that student. If it's found out that something untoward has happened, there's a direct link between the IP address that's in your log records and the credentials that were handed out to a particular student. Now that's not to say that there isn't real physical bullying going on and that a student has been forced to communicate their credentials to somebody else, to another student, or they may cooperatively do so, but at least at a technical level, we can identify very simply, very quickly and very easily that sign-in, that IP address in the log records, that set of credentials. So we've got a very granular IP address level of auditability and logging. We can also, at the firewall, don't forget, all of the traffic comes back to the tunnel broker. At the firewall, if we choose to, we can say simply, well, that IP address is now no longer going to be, none of its traffic is going to be communicated at all. So we have a very, very granular level of control over the use of the network. Okay, the experience with the overall project. We met with Google in November of 2007 before we started this whole journey. We planned for the transition to the new facilities, and we had decided, we had worked out that we could start in December 2008. We started transitioning the schools in December 2008, and by March 2009 we had converted the last of the schools that were already existing customers of StudentNet. Since then, other schools have found out about the facility and have now started to request to become part of the StudentNet network. So we're now taking on new schools, so our population growth of accounts is growing. Just most recently, we took on a new school who's brought on board 750 accounts, so I think about 600 students and 150 teachers and administration staff. We've also had one of our existing users just decide that they're going to push the program down, so not just the high school kids, and there were some 800 high school kids, but they're now going down as far as year one. So they've now brought in 600 primary school kids as well, so there's now 1,400 kids in that particular program, and they're only doing students. They're not doing any teachers or administration in their particular network. The question that they asked us, by the way, when they were talking about this is, should we make it available to the kindergarten kids as well? That's not a technical issue from my standpoint. That's really a school education issue, not a technical issue. So we feel that it's been a success, and we feel that part of the success has come from the fact that the schools that are using the program feel that they've got a competitive advantage, and I'll touch on this afternoon when I give my other talk, that they've got a competitive advantage in comparison to the schools that aren't part of the program. Thank you very much.
Do we have a question for Kevin? Okay. Well,
that's good.
Sorry.
What are some of the schools that you cover in New Zealand as well?
At this stage, we don't cover any schools in New Zealand. We'd love to cover some schools in New Zealand.
Yeah.
I had conversations when I gave this talk down in Christchurch. I spoke to some of the people, Enable Networks. They've got a schools program, and they're very keen to get. They've putting in place a backbone, I believe, that will link up all the schools with a 1 gigabyte backbone, and they're keen to get applications running on their backbone. And we're keen to talk to them about providing that. First off, there's no DHCP involved. Second off, they're our DNS servers. They're IPv6 now's own DNS servers. We had some issues with DNS in that we had to upgrade to the latest releases of Bind in order to properly support the dynamic allocation of the new hosts as the students log in. We've also had some issues in that we've had to change our internal change management procedures to ensure that we could work with that dynamic approach to the creation and deletion of the domain name records. So it did make a change to the way we were running our own DNSs. But we don't use DHCP at all. Is there another question?
You mentioned a couple of times Moodle, which is an open source Moodle, which is an open source learning management system.
Correct.
I wonder if you had any conflict on this deployment between proprietary and open source software?
No, we haven't had any conflict so far, because all we're dealing with is the directory. And as long as the proprietary software is authenticating using the same directory, we haven't noticed that there should be any reason for conflict. I believe that Google are introducing a facilities for ID management, so that not only will it be sign-on administration, but also single sign-on proper single sign-on, so that Google, I believe, will provide the facility so the student only needs to log in once, and they've logged into Moodle as well. Now, I don't think that's out at the moment, but we're in close communication with Google locally in Sydney, and we believe that that's on the cards. When that comes out, that'll be a great enhancement to what we've got. I don't know. I'd have to speak to my technical guys to find out where that's coming from. There's some sort of ID management that they're working on. Just the facility for the administrators of being able to have that one place of control for all of the passwords is a great boon for them.
Okay, we better move on. Thank you very, very much indeed, Kevin.
Thank you, Murray.
Right, our next presentation, case study, is FX Networks, and Mike Plant is going to present this today. He is GM of Operations at FX Networks, and we're delighted to have you along. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. A little bit of background for anybody who isn't aware of us. We're a national backbone carrier. We have fibre through the North and South Islands now. We've been finalists in the Next Generation Network Awards. We're an ISP who focuses mainly on business and high-end organisations. We have no real residential capability or desire to do so, but we partner with those organisations and other ISPs that do. The important thing is that we have native IPv6 dual stack support live since June 2009. As an example of that, we have native V6 out to Gisborne. If anybody wants it, let me know. I'll let Ruben know down the back there. He's actually in sales. How have we gone about it? Parallel support, we have gone the dual stack route. The important thing here is about reach. People in our office don't really care which protocol is used to get them across the internet. They just care that it works. And it's about reaching into all the parts of the world and around the internet that our customers or our users want to reach into. The important thing here is that the network is... The deployment of V6 is around facilitating the connectivity that people are looking for. We're not looking to create anything out of this, and we certainly aren't charging anybody for the privilege of using V6 over our network. We started this 18 months ago... basically because we wanted to be ready before the customer demand existed. We have had inquiries from around the internet community regarding access to V6, but we wanted to be really ahead of it. And you saw in the earlier presentations that the RFP process now is starting to slowly have a requirement for V6 coming out. We can tick yes on all of those. And the One Government project is an example of that. The things that we're doing with Massey University are another part. We were in a position to take advantage of that. We also recognise that irrespective of the fact that New Zealand is just a set of islands and we have probably a large amount of IPv4 space, the change is coming and we do need to be ready for it. And getting ahead of the game in our administration capabilities has been a really important part of what it is that we've done. So in terms of things like IP address allocation databases, our schemas for doing that type of thing, getting ahead of all of that, getting our engineering team up to speed, these things have taken a lot of time to get everybody's head around. It's complex, but it's not necessarily hard. And one of the things that we'll talk about a little bit later on is It's still not a day-to-day process for us. If we're not reaching out and touching IPv6 on a day-to-day basis, the knowledge gets lost. And so exposing our staff and our customers to it earlier is actually providing us with some significant advantages. We haven't seen IPv6 as a project. We've seen it as an extension of our business, and we've treated it as such. As part of our continual deployment strategies and enhancing our network, IPv6 has been on the roadmap with everything that we've done for 18 months, and it's been rolled in as part of a natural progression of upgrades and enhancements that we've made to all of our networks. Stability has been an important part of what it is that we've done, and that's why we've been able to take the last 18 months, work through labs, work through vendor-related issues, and deploy things in a sane and unhurried manner, which means that we can retain all the stability. For us, uptime is more important than anything else, and we've been able to reach those uptime goals and SLAs that we have with our customers through both our backbone and our ISP services by being able to take an approach whereby we're not staring down the gun of having to do anything in a major panic. Those of you who are familiar with Randy Bush's presentations may recognise these graphs. And essentially what we're looking at is the investment that we've been able, that we've had to make in terms of putting in V6 by starting earlier versus what would be the potential for later on should everybody decide to wait. How do we go about it? 18 months ago, we nominated our resident geek senior engineer as the person that would be most motivated to deal with V6 and dealing with all the issues. That person isn't me, but he is in the room if anybody has any questions. And basically, by taking responsibility for talking to our vendors and getting into the nuts and bolts of what a deployment of V6 would entail, has been able to, A, lead the development of our internal process around what we're going to be doing with that, and also act as a tech lead for dealing with our internal staff issues and bringing up our staff and their capabilities. 18 months ago, it was all about tunnels, it was all about experimenting, and it was all about dealing with things like MTUs and Hurricane Electric tunnels and various other bits and pieces that never really worked properly. And so 6 months ago, we were able to work with a carrier who was able to provide us with native IPv6 transport into New Zealand. And that really provided the catalyst for getting in and going with V6. It's taken us around 12 months to get ready, knowing where what the roadmap looked like, and then it's taken basically another 4 to 6 months to get to the point where we were able to announce it to the market as something that our network is now able to offer. Vendor support is still a critical issue, and it's one of the topics that we'll be discussing with Tony later this afternoon. There are various elements of the network which are not fully IPv6 compliant. We're having to pressure vendors to do full V6 support for a lot of their products. Examples, firewalls have already been mentioned, packet shapers are another one. Routers in and of themselves, not so bad today, depending on which products you're picking. But there are other elements of running an ISP where V6 capability is still, it's there, it's working. The amount of traffic that V6 is doing off our network is not significant enough for it to be of a major operational concern today, but we need to be sending a clear message out to the market and to our vendors that the time for them to start having things on their roadmap for full V6 support is 6 months ago. One of the major issues that we had to deal with was actually around DNS. The biggest issue that we had on the operational system side was reverse DNS, and that caused us all manner of problems to reach a solution for it. We managed to get there in the end. Internet NZ workshops have really, really helped. I urge everybody to participate if you don't already. There'll be workshops, I'm sure, planned for later this year or into early next year. Get involved. Get your key technical staff into those discussions and training sessions sooner rather than later. As I mentioned before, operational awareness is really important, but if you're not doing an awful lot of it, it's hard to maintain all of that, and that's why starting to build the body of knowledge within your organisation is a really, really important thing to do right now. And retaining clue is something that needs to be considered. We'd stress that everybody, you would need to provide some internal allocation for a V6 person. You don't want to be farming this out to external parties because eventually it will come around and bite you. You will end up needing to provide internal support for your applications, for your internal architectures. Bringing in external parties is not necessarily the wisest thing to do once you get 24 months down the road. The conclusions to end on, get on with it now. The time is now. Waiting for another 12 months, we're going to be staring down some pretty serious problems, and you don't want to be in the wrong part of that curve that we showed earlier before. One of the things that IPv6 is complex, but it's not necessarily hard. You heard Glenn talk earlier before. A lot of stuff just works. Yeah? I wouldn't recommend throwing anybody a textbook and saying, you're my IPv6 guy, because they're most likely to freak out and throw it back at you. Right? It hasn't been that bad in terms of actually getting to the stage where things are mostly operational. Yes, some of the back-end applications or support systems that we have in place have needed a little bit of work. Again, getting in front of the curve on the deployment has been a key part of all of that. IPv4 exhaustion is going to happen. We know this. Just want to make sure that everybody's aware of it yet again. And waiting for it to run out and waiting to the point where you have to deploy IPv6 tomorrow is going to hurt a lot. And it's going to hurt in the wallet. And it's going to hurt with all your users and the phone calls that you're going to get. Another thing, as I mentioned earlier, vendors. If you know of other organisations who have similar products to you, say, for example, Bluecoat, work with other potential customers that you know of in terms of putting together enough pressure onto those vendors to try and get their full V6 support put in place. I can't stress that enough. There are elements of the networking industry where it doesn't necessarily have the focus that it should have. By effectively coming along to Internet NZ workshops, forming effectively alliances to work with vendors and put the pressure. I mean, we are writing paper letters and signing them and sending them to vendors to say, what is your roadmap for this, please? We are doing this now. And it's slowly starting to take effect. And acting now, it's the only thing that you can do, and it's the responsible thing to do. Yeah, that was all I have to say. Any questions?
Thank you very much indeed. Is there a question?
Thank you very much.
Much appreciated.
In that presentation, please take note of the graphs. I think they're very illuminating and very useful to keep in the back of your mind. It's much easier to move now when you've got time and space than wait until you actually hit some form of barrier. Right, the next presentation is from Andrew Ruthven. He's an open source specialist with Catalyst. He's going to talk about the New Zealand Registry experience and its adoption of IPv6. Thank you very much indeed, Andrew.
Thank you, Murray. Right, so as the Honourable Nathan Guy alluded to earlier on, the NZ Registry Services has rolled out IPv6, and we actually did it 2 years ago. So I'm talking on behalf of Catalyst IT, who I work for, and this work was done for NZ Registry Services. Very quickly, some people may not know, what is the DNS? It takes the URLs, google.com, to an IP address. It's the white pages of the internet. This is critical infrastructure. Everybody expects it to just work. Most people don't think about the DNS. So when you start using IPv6, again, you want it to just continue to work. So NZRS didn't really have, nobody was knocking on a door saying, we need IPv6 now. They wanted to innovate and have that support out there for when people did want to use it. And we're doing the same thing with DNSSEC and IDN, where people aren't really knocking on the door, but, you know, it's coming. So the project goal is to be IPv6 ready, so that when people do want it, it's there. And the good news is, it's there now. I don't think we actually qualify for getting that badge because it's for hardware and software, but yeah. So the plan is, it is critical infrastructure. You expect it to work. You expect it to work like the roading system, like the shipping, and if you don't live in Wellington, the trains. I catch that train. I try to catch that train. So what approach did we take? We took a very, very low-risk approach. We've got quite high SLAs on the whole infrastructure around the DNS, so we don't want it to break. So what we did was the existing system.
Is there?
we bolted a bunch of machines on the side, and those are the IPv6 hosts. So we didn't touch any of the existing infrastructure. We put on new boxes. That is, they're all running Debian GNU Linux. It just worked. The name server software we're using is Bind9. It just worked. The Whois server, well, we had to make some minor changes to that because it was written a little while ago. Again, it just worked when we made the changes. The only problem we had was the logging format change for the IP addresses. That was a minor, trivial fix to get it back into our the way we wanted them to log. But, yeah, it just worked. However, well, and that's just reiterating what we did. So we did request the V6 addresses from APNIC. Because they classified DNS as critical infrastructure, we just got the address space. Not a problem. Catalyst, a little bit more effort to get the IP addresses, but you know, we managed to get it okay. A lot easier now for people. The only other thing there which I haven't covered is management of DNS reverse zones. I wrote a Perl script. We tried to use some of the tool set that's in Bind9, but it's V4 only for doing this, for doing reverse zones. Now, were there issues? Of course there were. This would be a very boring talk if there were no issues. And come on, this is what you're here to want to know about. What goes on? The first issue that we had was transit. We did this project in 2007. There was no native transit out of New Zealand on IPv6. We found one ISP that would sell us IPv6, but they used tunnels to the States. At this stage, Catalyst already had a tunnel to the States, so, you know, to the same provider. So I just rolled my own, did the same thing. So the New Zealand name servers are both running with tunnels through the States and are also connected to the peering exchanges, the IPv6 peering exchanges, both in Wellington and Auckland. Which brings us on to the next point, disrepair. The IPv6 peering exchanges were built several years before we did this. When we came to use them, they weren't actually working because nobody had been using them. We discovered this because I found out that Victoria University had V6 up and running and they were on the peering exchanges. So I tried talking to them and it didn't work. Oops. However, by working quite closely with Citylink, we managed to get that all resolved pretty quickly. So the peering exchanges now work. They now work great. A lot, you know, some traffic is going across it. Our traffic is going across it. When we do traffic to NZ Registry Services, we use the peering exchanges to do our V6 transit. It's great. Network accept policies. This is the there's a rule set which says these are the size of address blocks to accept if you want to be strict, because all the registries out there have a list of these are how we assign IP addresses. These are the size of blocks we give them out on. So some people out there are very strict and will only accept what are supposed to be advertised. It turned out that the address block that were given for the DNS servers wasn't in this list because the guy that had been maintaining this list relied on people to tell him, hey, this address block's now been given out in this size. I was the first person to mention the new APNIC block to him. The other problem that we encountered was he had no notification method to tell people that were using his list that it had changed. Oops. Fortunately, this won't affect most of the people in this room because you'll all be falling within the standard address block range. It didn't affect Catalyst. It only affected NZRS to a small extent. Not many people are actually strict. Most people don't even run any of these kinds of policies. Some people are anal. The biggest issue we had was knowledge and acceptance. Training, training, training. We ran into a huge amount of resistance with people not understanding IPv6 and not really seeing the point or the need. The resolution of that is to offer training to people. So we had 2 one-day training courses for our sysadmin staff, and that certainly helped a lot. This also comes down to the whole NAT equals security kind of side of things as well. You know, teach people what's going on and how these things work so they're more comfortable with them when there are issues. So, and this is actually from the Internet NZ training session that happened start of this year, last year. I wasn't there. So, quickly running over the summary of the issues. The first three are issues that you shouldn't be at, that you shouldn't hit in New Zealand nowadays. There is transit. By the way, I'd like to lodge a ticket with FX. I want IPv6 native, please. And also for NZRS, that'd be great. The spread of infrastructure, again, because people are now using it, it's not an issue. Network accept policies, most people won't hit it. The last one is the biggie. That's the one that you've always got to keep in mind. The whole training side of things. Yeah, and we worked around all those issues. Most of them we knew about as we went into the project or early on. The successes. Linux, it just worked. Name server software, it just worked. All those code changes, yeah, you get the story. And the whole IPv6 rollout, that project went really well. It's working now. As soon as we turned on the name servers with the entries in the root zone files, we saw queries. Not very many queries, but we saw queries. And we're still seeing, you know, all the way through to today. So that works really, really well. And it's allowed Internet NZ and NZ Directory Services to continue to innovate in the name server space and make sure that New Zealand's still up on the play. One other thing I'd just like to mention as well is in your handouts, there is a little pamphlet which Jay Daly's put together from NZRS, which is about enterprise IPv6 guidelines. One thing is it still has the current rules for address allocation, so hopefully that's changing in the next few weeks. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed.
Again, lots of focus on knowledge and experience and awareness across any form of implementation. Our final case study for today is one relating to the Microsoft journey, and Brett Roberts is going to come forward and present this. Brett is the CTO for Microsoft New Zealand and is going to provide the perspective from Microsoft.
Thank you very much indeed, Brett.
Thank you, Murray. And good afternoon, everybody. When I started delving into Microsoft and asking the question around what we were doing with regard to IPv6, it was an interesting journey. There was, without a doubt, an element of drinking from the fire hose, and there was also an aspect of trying to suck treacle through a straw. So there was parts of it that I could get large amounts of information about and it was overwhelming, and other parts, especially our internal IT guys, were relatively stum about things. So what I did was I tried to group things so I would find them easier to understand, and hopefully you would too. And they kind of fell into four P's, as I called them. So the first one of them is productivity. Second one being platform. The third one being provisioning. And the last one, futures, which is the part that really interests me. Productivity. Now, most of today's conversation, a lot of today's conversation has been about the technical elements of IPv6, and I understand that. I think one of the things, this is the third one of these events I've been to, one of the things that's really become apparent for me is that the technical requirement to do this is well understood. When did it need to be done? Yesterday. The timing is well understood. I think what's missing at the moment, or the piece that we as an industry need to work on, is the business part of it and selling it up the food chain. I think, personally, that's an area where we need to do some work. And interestingly enough, for the first time that I can recall in my 12 years with Microsoft here in New Zealand, we've got technical guys out on the street now talking to our customers, our consulting people, specifically about IPv6. And this is what's driving it, a technology called direct access, which in a nutshell, without getting too techie, because that would be a bad thing for me to do, enables a customer running a Windows Server 2008 R2 box on the periphery of their network and Windows 7 client machines out in the field to connect those machines to the network and have all of the resources inside the network appear just like they would if they were connected on the corporate network. There are no VPNs, there's no separate authentication, there's no nothing, it just works together. It will tunnel, as you saw in that transition there, it will tunnel over IPv4 if it really has to, but we'd prefer it didn't, and this is a technology that's absolutely lit up by IPv6. There are other technologies like that, and I think one of the things that we, again, as an industry, need to think about doing is how do we explain the business benefits of IPv6? And in this case, that's an absolute productivity driver. I think productivity is a word we'll all get to hear a hell of a lot of over the next few years. Platform's another part of it. So not only does Microsoft build applications that need to support IPv6, and as you saw before, can sort of light up new scenarios around that, but we also build technologies that enable others to build stuff on top of our stuff. They can build stuff, software for use inside their organisations, or independent software vendors can build applications and release those out to the world. And a big part of that, obviously, he says, clicking the button, are our development tools, Visual Basic, C#, etc., the technologies that sit under that, the fundamental technologies, identity discovery, communication technologies, and all of those things are currently and now IPv6 enabled. So an important thing for us to do, and no doubt other vendors are doing the same thing, is to ensure that the development tools that are being built are also IPv6 enabled. It's a big ecosystem. Third one, and this was the one that really intrigued me, was going out to our internal people and asking them about provisioning. Now, when you think about it, Microsoft is in an interesting position given that we are provisioning a very large internal network that supports probably a couple of 100,000 PCs at any given point in time, and maybe 100,000 or so people. We're also provisioning out networks for things like MSN, Azure, Hotmail, Live Services, Office Web Applications, Bing, and probably a couple that I've forgotten, Microsoft.com. And we're obviously therefore a consumer of IPv6 technology from large vendors. Now, one of the interesting things I found was getting anyone to talk to me around how some of our networking stuff externally is configured was very, very difficult. Internally, the story I got from our internal IT guys was that, again, this whole thing fell into a category of four Ps, and they were planning, 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 and problems. The planning part was interesting. We've rolled out IPv6 internally quite a while back, but one of the interesting things that happened was we ran into a massive showstopper bug with Cisco Kit. This was several years ago. We'd done a massive amount of planning. We had test-bedded things. We had done all of the work in the world, and when we came to actually roll it out, there was a specific issue in a specific Cisco box, and I'm not a Cisco guy, so I couldn't tell you what sort of box, that required Cisco taking it back and rewriting the firmware in that box. They sorted the problem out to their credit. It became a non-problem, and we rolled out the boxes all around the world, which was great, but never underestimate the ability for those little issues to crop up. Glenn from Massey made a couple of really good comments earlier on too about those little soft errors that you don't think about, those soft problems, those database fields that weren't quite provisioned outright 15 years ago when someone wrote them originally. Those little bits and pieces, the little gotchas, you do need to think about. And you can testbed these things that would appear to the nth degree when they get out in the field is when you really find those little bits and pieces. Those are the experiences. That's right, I knew there was another slide. So futures, this is the part that really interests me. The research I've done, the reading I've done, the conversations I've had internally, IPv6 is going to be very interesting in a couple of specific fields, I think fairly early on. Sensor networks and building control systems. And those two things are kind of interrelated in some ways. And to use a good example of that, the latest data center we've just built out in the States has thousands, many thousands of tiny little sensors dotted around the place that monitor the temperature in very small segments of the building, you know, literally second by second, in a sensor network. And that enables the building control systems to shift server load around the building to the cooler parts of the building, thereby saving power, therefore being a good thing from a green perspective as well. Now, you think about that, that's just a data center. You think about that extrapolated out to a massive skyscraper and the opportunity that provides to control that environment in a far more granular manner. And I think, again, you see there a business driver of the technology that we've all worked out, I think, over the last 3 days of these HUIs is something that has to be done. I think we need to think a little bit better around how we communicate these things on a business basis, and I think that's a good example of that. So my personal view of the world is that anything that has electrons running through it will have an IP address at some stage. It won't be this week, but it will be at some stage. I mean, the technology to do that is probably going to come down to the 5 cents or 2 cents point at some point in space and time, and every one of those things is going to need an IPv6 address. So yet again, there's some brand new opportunities that we haven't even envisaged yet that will be lit up by IPv6 technology. So these are the four things that, I don't know if there's one slide you want to take away, maybe this is it, when having a business conversation around IPv6, the four areas to centre it around. Talk about the platform, talk about app dev, talk about the connectivity that it provides. That was that first slide I popped up. And again, this whole concept of data collection, being able to reach into organisations, especially into government, pulling that information out and doing some very, very cool stuff with that. It's one of those scenarios. IPv6 really does need you. Thank you.
Thanks,
Murray.
Very much.